get from out the road when he get dull was horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, a fest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again and go up each time he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Saleh Emirova, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 and 2007, she served at the U.S. Department of Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saleh Emirova.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And today you testified in the United States Senate before a Senate subcommittee on financial institutions and consumer protection, a subcommittee of the Banking Committee chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. This is in response, I take it, to the New York Times story that was front page on Sunday revealing how Goldman Sachs has bought a company and warehouses aluminum ingots, which they sort of shuffle around in a kind of shell game, presumably to drive the price up of these commodities. So let's begin with that. Was this hearing in response to the New York Times article?
I don't think it was actually in response to the New York Times article. I think New York Times article and the hearing are both responding to the same trends that have been kind of at the center of attention, at least of certain people who followed banks and banks' involvement in commodities for quite some time. So, to me, this is a great fortunate timing. But I wouldn't necessarily say that the hearing was directly in response to the New York Times piece.
But the hearing is basically looking into Wall Street's ownership of warehouses, pipelines, and other commodity-related assets.
That's exactly right, yes.
Because I recall back in 2008, for example, 60 Minutes broke a story. That was when the price of gasoline went up to $147 a barrel. And 60 Minutes revealed that the biggest owner of oil at the time was J.P. Morgan Chase, and that they were filling up tankers that sort of, you know, steamed around in circles, holding all of this oil off the market in order to drive the price up. So we get these anecdotal stories, but we don't get the overall picture of how much these basic commodities like food and gasoline that consumers have to pay for and how much the prices are inflated. So was there a big picture presented today to the Senate?
Well, there was certainly an attempt made to present a picture that is, more complete than what we usually know and hear about. Is it possible to present in a single hearing the complete picture of such a complex phenomenon? Perhaps not. So my hope is that this hearing is only the beginning of a serious inquiry process into exactly the kinds of connections that you are pointing out. The fact is that what happens in the secretive world, for example, of oil trade and the oil derivatives trade, the financial instruments trade that is linked to the price of oil, to what extent those activities directly affect the price of gasoline that everyday ordinary Americans have to pay every day, that's actually quite a complicated question. And I'm hoping that by looking into the kind of legal and policy implications of allowing J.P. Morgan's and Goldman Sachs's of this world to get engaged in this kind of market, we will at least start getting some tangible answers that would allow us to figure out whether or not such a connection actually exists.
Well, it does feel very coincidental that all of a sudden, on the biggest driving weekend of the summer, suddenly oil prices go up, and they've been going up arbitrarily here in California. I mean, I think one can rightly have a healthy suspicion that the market's being gained, because at the time that oil was up at $147 a barrel, the Saudis were saying, it's not us,
Of course. course, yeah. No, I completely agree with you. And in fact, I do share your suspicion. It is absolutely a legitimate question to be asked, because for example, financial institutions will tell us is that the fluctuations of gas prices and oil prices are determined as usual by the normal interaction between supply and demand. But it doesn't explain the swings and the sort of incredible, unprecedented rise, even in the kind of magnitude of prices of a single barrel of oil in the past decade. And of course, it did coincide with the financialization of commodities markets. So it coincided with the expansion of the financial institutions into commodities markets, both on the financial side, but also very importantly on the physical side. It also expanded with, along with the kind of influx of purely financial investors into the commodities as an asset class. And again, one might ask, why would investors start seeking, investments in commodities that, while financial investments seem to be directly affecting actual cash prices, right, in the spot markets? So one possible answer would be is that the same financial institutions, same Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley of the world, are actually marketing these types of financial products to potential investors. So this what you call the gaming of the market is a very multi-layered phenomenon, right? It's not just a simple kind of manipulation of prices, but it's also changing the underlying dynamics of price determination in these markets to introduce factors that typically have not been part of that dynamics, like financial speculative interests, for instance.
And again, I'm speaking with Soleil Omarova, who's professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 to 2007, she served at the United States Department of the Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. So, but it's worth noting that this new, the financialization of commodities, as you have put it, that's through what is called the Goldman Sachs Index. And it has obviously attracted an enormous amount of speculative money. And traditionally, the commodities markets were dictated by end users of commodities, like oil refineries who would be interested in the price of oil, and they would want to cover their bets and try and look ahead and get the best price. And the same with Pillsbury and all these big companies like Kellogg's. They'd be interested in the price of grain. And in response to this New York Times story about how Goldman Sachs, through its ownership of Metro International Trade Services, have been warehousing aluminum ingots and sort of doing a shell game, shuffling them around from warehouse to warehouse to drive the price up. That, of course, has attracted the ire of the big beer brewing companies who need the aluminum for their aluminum cans. So is this the problem, is that a market that was normally driven by the end users has now been taken over by speculators?
That is definitely a part of the problem, like I said before, and like you said just now. Traditionally, these markets, be it commodity futures or even more so actual physical commodities markets, were dominated by producers of those commodities, traders who are not financial institutions, and end users. And so the supply and demand really drove a lot of the pricing there. And when supply and demand for actual production enterprises of metals or oil or whatever the commodity we're talking about determines the price for that commodity, then there is sort of a natural level, right, within which or a natural range within which such prices may fluctuate from time to time. However, once you introduce this whole new class and potentially unlimited class of players into that market, those are the players that have no commercial end-user type interest in the underlying commodity, but only viewing it as an asset class, right? Same as potentially maybe securities or whatever else, mortgages. and now they're investing in commodities or commodity futures, for example, then those investors with a lot of money and seeking to park that money to make to put that money to work to generate returns, they may very well, you know, upset that that balance of kind of supply and demand, producers and end users. And so once the financial institutions actually step into that intermediary role and become the traders in those markets, both in the financial derivatives, commodity derivatives markets, and in the physical commodities markets, then we're talking about a qualitative change, at least potentially, in how the market operates. And I think that's what we're seeing today. It's very difficult to figure out exactly, you know, why a particular commodities price is spiking at one point, not at the other point. You know, it's difficult to get a handle on what determines these prices at this point.
So you, of course, testified today, Sole Amorova, before this subcommittee on financial institutions and consumer protection, a part of the Senate Banking Committee chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. There was, of course, a representative of MillerCoors, who are the end users for aluminum cans, which they put their beer in, and they're obviously feeling the pinch from the gaming of the aluminum market. What part of the picture did you cover in your testimony?
So I'm a banking law scholar, so I viewed my job as setting forth the broader legal and political regulatory implications of this phenomenon, namely large U.S. financial institutions becoming effectively physical commodity and energy merchants. So I looked at the potential policy concerns that, for example, are triggered by this phenomenon. You know, do we worry about, for example, the safety and soundness of our banking system because the bank's affiliates or sister companies are now actually drilling for oil or operating oil tankers? Do we worry about systemic risk implications of whatever risky activities these institutions might be conducting, market manipulation, consumer protection concerns? What about, you know, oversight and regulation? Is there currently a single regulator, for example, capable of effectively overseeing all these activities that, you know, are spread around so many different sectors of the economy, not just finance? And so those are the concerns that I try to bring up to the attention of the senators, basically making an argument that perhaps this potential concern can be easily alleviated if we had enough data and enough information on what exactly is going on and how it's all being managed and what kind of consequences for the market, for the end users of commodities, for the society in general, these things may have. However, my task today was to emphasize the need for that inquiry.
So in terms of what happened with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, where the wall that was put up since the Depression between investment banks and banks was taken down, and it obviously led to, in part or in whole, if you will, to the crash of 2008. And now, of course, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Maria Cantwell and John McCain are trying to bring back Glass-Steagall. So was there a similar wall that existed between banks and the ownership of the means of controlling commodities and pipelines and warehouses and oil tankers and drilling for oil, et cetera? Was there a wall that was taken down in the way that Glass-Steagall was repealed?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the foundational principles of U.S. banking law is the so-called principle of separation of banking from commerce, which basically says a banking institution should not be engaging in commercial enterprise in order to avoid potential conflicts of interest and risks to the safety and soundness of that bank and so on and so forth. So since 1863, when the National Bank Act was adopted, the banks themselves, in other words, the deposit-taking institutions, have been generally prohibited from engaging in anything that is not banking or business of banking, and that was a fairly narrow term. So other than gold and bullion, they couldn't trade in any physical commodities. Now, in 1956, Congress passed another statute, the Bank Holding Company Act, and that statute explicitly imposed similar activity restrictions, not only on the banks themselves, but also on bank holding companies or their parent companies. So now, any company that owned or controlled the bank, directly or indirectly through any subsidiary, was generally prohibited from engaging in any commercial activity, other than a very narrow band of certain very small passive investments they might, they could make under the law. Now, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999, when it partially repealed the Glass-Steagall separation between, you know, Glass-Steagall Act by, you know, allowing the affiliation of commercial and investment banks, also, in addition to that, provided certain additional sources of authority for banking organizations, for the bank holding companies, not banks themselves, but their parent companies, to conduct commercial activities. So in that sense, Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act not only eliminated the wall between commercial and investment banking, but also significantly relaxed the prohibition on bank holding companies conducting purely commercial activities. So that happened in 1999, and then, not surprisingly, in the early 2000s, once the commodities boom started, this was a point at which those bank holding companies, Citigroup and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan, started coming to the Fed, asking them to allow them to trade physical commodities, pursuant to the new authority that Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act created. So in that sense, yes, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act not only eliminated the separation between commercial and investment banking, it also significantly undermined the separation between banking and commerce.
So, Sola Ambarova, obviously the banking lobby is, I think, considered one of the most powerful in Washington. But when you've got people that were testifying today against the gaming of commodity prices and the growing power of banks to influence, if not control, the prices of basic commodities, and in this case, aluminum. So you had the representative from MillerCoors, and presumably you would also, people, for example, like airlines would be concerned about the price of gas, refineries would. I mentioned earlier the big food agribusiness companies like Pillsbury and Kellogg's, they're concerned about the price of grain. Is it possible that those kind of companies can act as a counter lobby against the banking lobby, which clearly has got its way so far?
You know, in a healthy pluralist democracy, that would be an assumption, that whenever one special interest group gathers too much power, there'll be a countervailing, you know, set of interests that would actually oppose such concentration of power. And under normal circumstances, that's how it's supposed to work. However, something changes when the banking lobby, right, or whatever, the banking industry, the financial industry that accumulates all that power sort of becomes a major player in these commodity markets. Because when, you know, if you think about it, when Coca-Cola is facing Goldman Sachs, in Goldman Sachs' capacity as a warehouse operator, right, and Coca-Cola is very unhappy about what Goldman Sachs is doing as a warehousing operator, perhaps they would have, you know, been much more aggressive in pushing somehow, you know, Goldman Sachs back to, you know, where it should be, if Goldman Sachs was just a standalone warehousing operator, right? But in this case, Coca-Cola is looking at the situation and says, is it really a wise move for me potentially to go into this open political fight with Goldman Sachs? Not only because it's powerful, but also I am tied potentially or maybe in reality to Goldman Sachs in so many other ways, right? For example, Coca-Cola may be obtaining credit from Goldman Sachs or, you know, another banking institution. It may be retaining Goldman Sachs to underwrite its security issuances, advise it on various corporate transactions, provide various hedging solutions along a variety of lines. In other words, the grip that Goldman Sachs may have over an industrial company, even a large corporation, potentially, you know, powerful corporation, may outweigh this sort of expectation that we normally have that in a pluralist democracy, these companies will just lobby against Goldman Sachs and everything will get back to some kind of normalcy.
Well, just in closing, Sola Elmarova, what can citizens and consumers do? Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are getting gouged. Every time you go to the gas pump or put food on the table, you're paying a premium for the speculation that goes on that's driven the price up and adds absolutely no value to the economy. It's just a form of extraction at the top at the expense of the middle class and working Americans. It really feels like we're subsidizing a bunch of parasites. So what can be done in terms of political action here to get the middle class and working Americans to assert themselves against the power of the banking lobby?
That's a very important and a difficult question in some ways. Well, first of all, I think people, the American public, should start paying much closer attention to what's going on in the banking regulation and financial regulation area. To the extent possible, try to educate themselves, try to follow the news, you know, and not let the industry and industry lobbyists to fool us by telling us that everything is great, you know. And perhaps if people, you know, attempted to exert greater pressure on their elected representatives just to look into this issue, to quiz and to probe the industry rather than take everything, you know, on faith. Maybe that will help.
Well, Sola Elmarova, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sola Elmarova, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 to 2007, she served at the United States Department of the Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. And today, she testified before the Subcommittee on Financial Institutions and Consumer Protection of the Senate Banking Committee, chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.